Derby 104.
It's 11:05. It's Abbey 104 on Sunday morning. It's Folk Tales. I'm Terry Bennett, and in the studio this morning I've got Bill Taylor. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Thank you. Bill, you are currently a Sherborne Town councillor.
That's right.
Your career has been in journalism and writing and television. Many other things besides.
All of that. I've had a very lucky life, but at about the age of 14, training to be an engineer, really, doing maths and science at school, I had my head absolutely turned by books, by literature. Still read some of the books I read then. So always wanted to be a journalist, worked in newspapers, in TV, and for the last 10 years I've run my own communications company. So as I say, it's been a lucky life.
And that's taken you quite some distances. You were in Sydney for a number of years.
I travelled all over the world, so I had a couple of working trips around the world. Mm. And at that stage, life seemed, maybe I have a golden memory, but life seemed a bit easier. And there was a stage of my life in my 20s, for example, where I could pretty well get on a plane, get off in an English-speaking country, work as a reporter for a while or a sub-editor, save up enough for another air ticket, and then go on, as I did very happily for quite a long time.
Great life.
Indeed.
And, I mean, amongst many other things, you were one of the founders of the BBC News Channel.
That's right.
We very much take for granted now, but it wasn't always there, was it?
We do, and that, I think that was a huge revolution, and or part of the revolution in the way we consume news, to use that horrible phrase, and that led on to the later part of my life. But as I say, I've been very lucky, and after a lot of travelling and a lot of study, I moved from newspapers to broadcasting, worked for more than 10 years at ITN, and then went to the BBC, and towards the end of the BBC, my BBC time, became one of the founding editors of what was then News 24. And it's so much part of our culture now that we don't think about it. But it was a huge revolutionary change at that time.
Oh, it was indeed. We'll come back to that a little bit later, but let's start with your first track, logically. And this is a piece of Bach, isn't it? Albeit with a twist.
Piece of Bach. So played by Jacques Lussier, a French pianist who very sadly died a couple of months ago. And amid all the wonderful noise of the 1960s, when I was a young teenager, there's beautiful jazz came through the airwaves and onto records. The story goes that Jacques Lussier was classically trained, and during a competition at the Conservatoire in Paris, he sort of lost his way and started to ad-lib. And that's where he started to give a jazz swing to Bach. And Bach's the man, really, who makes my hair stand on end. This is the Siciliano in G minor.
Thank you. Well, the Jacques Lussier trio there with the Siciliana in G minor by J.S. Bach, BWV 1031. And that was an arrangement of the second movement of it, chosen by my guest this morning, Bill Taylor, who is a Sherborne Town Councillor, but many other things besides in his long working career. But Bill, obviously from your accent, it didn't all start in Dorset.
That's true. Born in central Scotland, in a pit village about 25 miles south of Glasgow. My folks were, on both sides of my family, coal mining folks for a couple of generations. And I was a little boy at the very tail end of that old-fashioned coal, steel and ships economy. Pits were still working in my village. At night, we could see the glow from the blast furnace at Ravenscraig Steelworks, and not too far up the road was Upper Clyde Shipbuilders. And of course, that economy died. And that was the formative things of my childhood. My father always saying, look, the pits are dying. You're not going to go down the mine. Get an education. Get out. And that's exactly what happened, really.
Mm. And tell me about early life then in that area. Was it just you, or did you have brothers and sisters?
Only child. I did have a brother and sister who were twin, who tragically died in childhood. And then it was just me. So I was an only child in a village of about 5,000 folks. So I spent my childhood in a traditional and very happy village, in the sense that I always walked to school. I went to school in the village until I was 16. And that was a good and a bad thing, because if you were naughty, to be honest, everybody in the village knew my folks. So if I'd been misbehaving by the time I got home, my folks knew about it, and I was in trouble again. But also, although it was a pit village, it was sort of on the edge of sort of Borders Hills, if you like. So there's lots of country life, lots of moorland to walk in. And I had a delightful, free and very happy childhood. I know most folk probably say that, but it was true in my case.
That's great. An enjoyable school as well?
Enjoyable school. Well, Scotland placed then, and still does, I think, a great value on state education and everybody. And the Dominie was a big figure in all of our lives. And I think myself privileged to have been involved in that kind of schooling. As I say, when I went to secondary school, my dad, again, quite rightly, thought that the way to be safe in a world that had been racked by unemployment was to be a professional, to be an engineer. And I studied maths and science and loved that and was good at it and all the rest of it. But when I was 14, I had my head turned by an inspirational English teacher called Elsie Lees, who was then just a couple of years to retirement, and started reading seriously Steinbeck, Hemingway, Graham Greene, Yeats, T.S. Eliot, and decided pretty well that engineering couldn't be for me. And decided at the age of 14 I was going to be a journalist and dedicated all my energy to making that happen.
Now, you mentioned quite a heritage of coal mining there. Your dad was in the pits and your mother was a daughter of a coal miner. But there was never any thought that you would follow into that. Dad had decided that the coal industry was
not only never any thought, but the absolute and quite proper realisation that the pits were dying. And even if they hadn't been, it wasn't much of a life. So my beloved grandfather, he spent all of his life down the pit. And when he wasn't in the pit, he was in the First World War suffering a gas attack. So as you might imagine, he died from miner's lung. His lungs weren't in a great state. And in the last few years of his life, he got a job as, I don't know if they have them anymore, a local council rural road mender. So he had a cart and all that. And he filled potholes and tidied up the verges. And he thought, after a life in the pits and a life on the Western Front, that this was an absolutely glorious and inspirational release, because he could lift his head up and see the horizon. He worked in rain and shine in rural roads, and because he'd lived in the village all of his life, everybody who passed knew him, so he'd pause for 5 minutes or so and have a chat. But yeah, the pits were never on my agenda, and never could be, I don't think.
You mentioned an inspirational English teacher. Would you say that that teacher was quite foundational in the way that you then did go? Because what early career thoughts had you?
No doubt about it. I was on the training track to be an engineer, and for the first few months of my working life, joined a very prestigious Glasgow engineering company where you did an extended training. So you worked and you studied for, I think, what was then called a sandwich degree. And my folks thought, that's fantastic. The boy's made it. He's on a track to be a professional. He won't go through the same upheavals that we've gone through in our life. But quite the same time, I'd been secretly writing away to newspaper editors saying, you need to give me a job. And one of them did. And while my dad was on holiday, I gave up my engineering job, my engineering training, moved to the newspaper. And it's the only time in my life that I've seen my rather quiet father completely beside himself with rage. He thought I'd absolutely lost the plot.
What was it about journalism that he thought was not suitable then?
Well, towards the end of the argument that we had, that memorable argument in my young life, and he said, and anyway, what does a reporter do? And I was a bit flummoxed by that. And I thought, well, they tell stories. And I won't repeat what came out of them at that stage. But understandably, I guess, they thought it was much less tangible, it was much less secure, and I was taking a big risk and giving up lots of the things that I'd worked for. For me, it was a dream ticket. And there's no doubt I've been a lucky man in the sense that I've always been able to earn my living doing something that I loved and I felt was my vocation. So fantastic.
And from your point of view, what was the attraction in those really early days, you were still a teenager, of going and working for a newspaper? What did you think that life was going to be?
The original inspiration, as I say, was that English class. So, and a book I still read every year, Graham Greene's The Quiet American. And I was suddenly had my head turned to the power of writing. So how does a working class boy earn his living writing? My only thought was, I got to be a journalist. Mm. And of course, it was the 1960s. It was a busy time. There was a lot happening. And I just felt that would be an exciting life that would. And indeed, it so turned out to be.
Yes. No regrets on that front, anyway.
None at all.
Let's have your second record. This is Jack Broadbent. Tell us about this.
So the story of this is, in that, we talked before about the wonderful noise of the 1960s. I was a great fan of Jimi Hendrix, and The Wind Cries Mary was my favourite Jimi Hendrix track. And when I first became a newspaper editor, at the very young age of 20, I was appointed editor of two regional papers in central Scotland. And when the managing director of the newspaper company took me into the newsroom, about half of the staff were easily more than twice my age. And they made absolutely no bones at all about what they thought about this long-haired Carlo youth coming in to run their lives. So I went home that night and I put this track on. And this version, which was played at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 2016, is by a new star in slide guitar, if you like. He's called Jack Broadbent. He was born in Lincolnshire, and he's wowing audiences all over the world. So this is Jack Broadbent's version of The Wind Cries Mary.
After all the jacks are in their boxes, and the clowns have all gone to bed, you can hear happiness staggering on down the street. Footprints dressed in red. And the wind whispers, Mary. A broom is drearily sweeping of the broken pieces of yesterday's life. Somewhere a queen is weeping. Somewhere a king has no right. And the wind cries, Mary. Thank you. laugh at last, they turn blue tomorrow. The shines that's emptying us down on my bed. Tiny island sights on downstream. Cause the life we live is dead. And the wind screams. Remember the names it has blown in the past. And with its crutch, its old age, and its wisdom, it's put snow. This will be the last. And the wind cries, Mary.
Jack Broadbent there, and The Wind Cries Mary, recorded at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 2016. My guest today in the studio is Bill Taylor, Sherborne Town Councillor. But we got to the stage in your working life, Bill, well, right at the beginning of your working life, really, where you went off and joined a newspaper as a teenager. What, were you 16 or 17?
I was just turned 17. And I got a job as a junior reporter at what was then a family-owned newspaper called the Hamilton Advertiser. Quite a big deal. I mean, they had a newsroom of about 8 or 9 reporters. They sold about nearly 50,000 copies a week. So it was a big time then for regional newspapers. And I had a great training. I did pretty well everything. And everybody said that the editor used to say that I had a great obituary voice. One of my jobs was to phone up the poor relatives of who'd lost somebody and get enough information from them to write an obituary. Right. And it was perceived that I had just the right voice. And then later in my career, when I had to do that, I was at the Scotsman in Edinburgh, I had to do that horrible job of going to get pictures and, again, information about people who passed away in some tragedy, a crash or a fire or whatever it was. And they always sent me because they thought I had a sympathetic face and a sympathetic voice. So,
but life generally then, as a young reporter on a regional newspaper, I imagine that you got your fair share of fairly routine stuff to start with, so going out and covering the village fates and...
Well, the great thing about the training was exactly that. You do have a measure of the village fates, but you get to do an enormously wide range of stories, courts, accidents, features, profiles, all the rest of it. And over the space of 3 years, which was my, if you like, my apprenticeship, I did pretty well everything that was needed to produce a newspaper. Pre-computerisation, of course. I was fascinated by the production process. But I went from the Hamilton Advertiser to the Glasgow Evening Times, and that was a really tough school in the sense that Glasgow at that stage, we forget what media used to be like. Glasgow at that stage still had 2 rival evening newspapers. And remember Saturday afternoons when you went to the pictures and people would be waiting for the paper to see the football results and all that kind of thing. So we'd go on a job. It shows you how long ago. I'm a really old person. Shows you how long ago it is. We'd go on a job and there would be a car and a driver and you'd do the story, turn it around quite quickly, whether it was a fire or a crash or an interview, and you'd phone it in on the radio phone. Bank of copy takers would take it. By the time you got back to the office, the news editor would be sitting with the rival paper on his desk and say, but hang on a minute, it says here that the grandmother threw the baby out of the 3rd floor burning flat to be caught by... And you don't have any of that. What have you been doing? Go back out and do it again. And so it was a constant battle to beat the opposition. And the good news about that was it was a great training.
Absolutely. Did you find the move from the regional paper to the Glasgow Evening Standard or whatever it was called, was that quite a big leap up?
The Glasgow Evening Times, yeah. I mean, it was a whole different thing. You were coming out every day. You had to be very quick. And you were up against and working with very talented, very experienced people who were very ambitious. So you had to be on the money. And so that was both exciting and profoundly stressful at the same time. But that's the nature of the beast. And if you work in that kind of field, then you want to be the best that you can get.
Well, you were obviously pretty good at it because, as you alluded to a minute ago, you were soon producing newspapers.
Yep.
How did that come about?
So the managing director of the paper where I trained, the Hamilton Advertiser, said, in our group, we've just bought over a couple of weekly papers. We want you to come back and edit them. And I was just turned 21. I had hair down past my shoulders. If I had one suit, I would have been lucky. And that was a whole different kind of training. Not only the production of the newspapers, but doing things under great financial constraint, but really working with and trying to run a team, probably about half of whom didn't want you there, didn't think you were up to it, and thought they should have had the job instead. And that was a different kind of learning process.
You found that tough, I imagine.
Yeah. But again, along with the toughness goes the excitement and the ambition and the desire just to do a good job. So there was never any doubt that this was my calling, is maybe too hard a word, but certainly my vocation. It's what I wanted to do. That's what I ended up doing all of my life. And everywhere I went, I learned not only something, but quite a lot. But after a while of being a weekly newspaper editor, I said, right, okay, I've been a good boy for long enough. I'm going to travel for a bit.
All right. How did you engineer that then?
Well, at that stage, in many ways, I think life has become, in a practical sense, much more difficult. But in that stage, I could buy an air ticket. I could land in an English-speaking country. And I could, so for example, in my first trip, when I travelled twice around the world, my first trip, I eventually arrived in New Zealand. I got a cabin from the airport and a motel. The next morning, phoned the news editor of the local paper in Wellington saying, I've just arrived, you got a job. And it happened that the guy who was running the paper had been trained in Glasgow and said, sure, come in.
Quite a big risk to take, really, isn't it?
Big risk to take, but, you know, I was young. I wanted to travel. It was great fun. And then I would be in a place long enough to save up for another air ticket. But again, to show you how informal life was, what happened in New Zealand, because the Australian newspapers were always searching for talent, a headhunter used to come over to Wellington, install himself in one of the hotels, and the word went round, so-and-so is in the bar. He'll be in the bar from 6 to 8 if you want to go and talk. So I went to see this guy and had a beer and thought, well, that's the end of that. 3 days later, I got a telegram, a huge, long telegram. Remember telegrams?
Yes.
We'd like to offer you a job as a sub-editor on the Sydney Morning Herald. Here's the deal. Here's the money. Go to this shop in Wellington and they'll give you an air ticket. And yeah. I thought, okay. And that was the sort of mood of that period, that extended period of travelling. So the Antipodes, all over the Pacific, Southeast Asia, Canada, a bit of the States, and a little bit of Europe. But it was easier, obviously, for me to get a job in an English-speaking country. Or in countries like those in Southeast Asia and Asia, where they still had lots of English language newspapers.
You did go to Australia, and you had quite an extended period at the Sydney Morning Herald.
Sydney Morning Herald. Well, I was back from one of my trips and working as a reporter in The Scotsman. And again, these are my 20s, so you're building up as much experience as you can. And I got a letter this time, not a telegram, from the night editor of the Sydney Morning Herald saying, we'd like you to come back and we'll give you a job. So I went back to Sydney and I lived in Sydney for nearly 10 years. And not having been to university, having started as a young reporter when I was 17, I went to university in Sydney. So I worked as a sub-editor on the Sydney Morning Herald, which is a night job. I went to university during the day. In the few hours that were left, I either slept or lay on the beach. And I had arguably one of the most glorious times of my life and feel enormously privileged to have been able to do that.
And what was life like living in Sydney in, well, this would be the 70s, presumably?
Yeah, it's the 70s. Well, you can imagine sunny Sydney, not quite the sort of international city that it is now, but glorious beaches, glorious harbour, very good universities, good newspapers, and a lot of fun, actually. And I remember my first... so there's another story. I went to university. I wanted to study with a guy called Harold Oliver, who was a Shakespeare scholar and one of the big deals in English literature. But I had to get his special permission. I got into the university, but I had to get permission from him to study English. So I went in nervously and did my spiel. And he said, look, when I was a postgraduate student, I taught minors at the Workers' Educational Association just down the road from where you were brought up. It would be a privilege to have you. And so, I mean, you can't argue with that kind of serendipity, really.
No, of course.
Let's have your third track, and then we'll come back and find out what happened next. It's Dollar Brand.
Forward the tape. Remember tapes? A little bit. One of the big jobs I did at ITN was I was a young TV news producer at the First Gulf War and spent, I can't remember, about 4 months in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. In the early part of the war, people still thought that Saddam's missiles, those Scud missiles, would have germ warfare on them. And as you remember, that was my first experience of total war with the air war and then the big ground forces and all the rest of it. And we were turning round an enormous amount of material and sending it back to ITN. And you get pretty exhausted quite quickly. And sometimes you get a bit anxious. And when I went back to my hotel at night, I bought this in a sort of bootleg version of this CD called Zimbabwe in a market in Dharan in Saudi Arabia. And I would play it at night when I went back to my hotel. So Dollar Brand was the first name of a universally respected jazz pianist called Abdullah Ibrahim, who was one of the guys who was very prominent in Cape Town when music was a way that black and whites could come together in the midst of apartheid. Thank you.
track there called Kramat. I think that's how you pronounce it, Bill, is it? Kramat or Kramat?
I think so, yeah. Kramat?
Yes.
I think so, yeah.
Anyway, it's by Dollar Brand, and he is a South African pianist and composer. From 1987, that particular recording, chosen by Bill Taylor, my guest in the studio. Bill, we left off that you were working for the Sydney Morning Herald and enjoying life in Australia, but you inevitably decided to move on eventually. What occasioned that?
What happened was that, as you might imagine, I'd been burning the candle at every possible end. So I'd been working at night and studying during the day, doing an honours degree, getting a great degree, and I was just exhausted. So I said, OK, I graduated and gave up my job at the Sydney Morning Herald, went on a trip and said, OK, let's see what happens next time. And I travelled across the Pacific and across Canada and wrote a whole lot of features. And when I got to London, I was doing some freelance work at ITN, my first taste of broadcasting, just thinking I'll earn some money while I decide what the next phase is. And after a couple of months, they said, do you want a job? And that was me for the next 10 years and more.
So this was a move, quite a big move, really, into broadcasting, as you say, as opposed to the written.
I'd always been a newspaper guy, so it was an unplanned move. But again, it was a lucky move. I felt myself very privileged. So ITN, now ITV News, was the small brother of the BBC. And part of our reason for existence was to do it better than BBC News, we thought anyway. And it was a relatively small company. Everybody knew everybody else. The editor knew everybody in the newsroom. And it was a very exciting time, and a time where I learned broadcasting, really, which I'd never done before, and learned picture editing. And a lot of people, so Sandy Gold, for example, was still newscasting. He'd been covering Vietnam when they used to send film back to be processed. Can we remember that far back? So there was a vast range of experience. And I remember first night that I actually wrote something, it was for News at 10, and I was sitting very nervously at the back of the gallery. And the director, Diana Edwards-Jones, who was a really colourful character, said, "Who the hell wrote this then?" And she screwed up this bit of paper and threw it over the gallery, and I kind of slunk out. But actually, I learned an awful lot quite quickly and had a great affection. And at ITN, the man who most influenced my life as a journalist was my boss there. Lovely guy called Derek Dowsett. He's now sadly in his mid-90s, but still around. And he gathered around him a group of ambitious, really talented people. And we would all run back to him and say, well, we've got this and we've got that, and these pictures have come. Because it was a great marketplace where pictures came from all over the world. And he said, yeah, but what's the story? And that became the defining theme of the rest of my life. Look, what really is the story here? Never mind the noise and the money and the pictures and all the rest of it. What are you trying to say? And he influenced me probably more than any other individual. So if he's listening, and well, he can't listen, it's Abbey FM, but in his care home.
He can listen online.
In Kent, in his care home in Kent, if he ever gets to hear this, Derek, thank you.
When you were talking about your school days, you mentioned that one of the things that got you into journalism was an English teacher, and that obviously was associated with the written word. You're now into broadcasting. How significantly different did it lose any of that magic that you'd found with being an ordinary reporter?
To be honest, a little bit. And I was snootily at the time. I snootily thought that newspapers and the written word were a superior art form, and broadcasting was a bit shoddy. So I think broadcasting can't do an awful lot of what the written word does. But as I discovered, it's a different art, it's a different skill, and you have to do it differently. And it was a very different time, of course. So I arrived at ITN in the early 1980s. I was there for more than 10 years before I went to the BBC. At that stage, everything in my life now seems a very long time ago. At that stage, there were four or five main TV channels. Vast numbers of people. I remember making documentary. I remember making a documentary about at ITN about Charles and Diana and the strains on their marriage, and we had 17 million viewers. So the whole landscape of broadcasting was very, very different, and it became a very exciting time. But the truth is, if truth be to tell, I never lost my affection for the written word, and probably prefer it.
Well, as we'll see in a moment, you're obviously back into that in the form of being an author. But just tell us about your move to the BBC. How did that come about?
Again, you get to a stage in working life where you think, or I certainly did, that you've done all you can. You know, there's another move around in the hierarchy. You think, okay, perhaps time to move on. Where is there to go? Well, Sky News was just starting, but I went to the BBC and thought it would be great to be in a really big player. And worked as a news producer there for a while and then became one of the founding editors of what was then News 24, the BBC 24-hour TV news channel. And that was a complete revelation.
I imagine that must have been a huge project before it actually launched. Yeah. That must have lasted years in the inception, would it?
It was a huge project. So when we started, the technology was completely new. And when we started to put the teams together, the technology didn't exist. You know, they hadn't built machines yet. And a lot of our early life was hear 'em, scare 'em, trying to stay on air. But if you think that we'd been used to a culture where news producers might have, in terms of news, three bulletins a day, half hour maximum length, sometimes shorter. Now you are on air for 24 hours without stopping and trying to do that with pictures and trying to do it cleanly and tell story well and being very responsive. And at the time, as I say, the technology was completely new. And it was that old story. We come back to that. It was that combination of being very scary and very exciting at the same time. But it did lead to one of the great crises in my professional life where quite soon, after a couple of years, I thought, I've been complicit here in the birth of a monster, because you've got this Gatling gun effect of undigested fragments of picture and news that are just firing out all the time. They often don't get a chance to coalesce around a well-told or carefully judged story, and they change our culture, I think. I think they change the political culture, and I think they change the way we all pursue news. And that eventually led me to think, okay, I need to do something else in the, as it were, the final stage of my career.
How long did you stay with the BBC?
Oh, I was there for about 8 years, something like that. Mm.
But as you say, the time came when you thought, let's move on to something else, and you actually formed your own company.
I formed my own communications company and worked all over the world helping social enterprises, charities and NGOs with communications.
And in what sense? What sort of things would you get involved with?
So I worked, for example, for a charity in London who were in turn helping a group of broadcasters in Kosovo and the Balkans about how to re-establish a fair broadcasting system after the civil war. I worked in the Middle East and China in various corporate jobs. And I worked in the UK prison system trying to tell the story of staff and inmate efforts to reform the prison system. But most importantly for me, I worked, and one of the reasons I chose the Bach Siciliano, I've worked for the last 2-3 years in southern Italy trying to help social enterprises that take on the mafia by trying to establish legal businesses. And I've been doing their English language communications. And what I try and do, rather than being a PR man, is I've always, in the last 10 years, been trying to give voice to people who don't naturally have a platform or find it difficult to make their message heard. And in southern Italy, that's been a revelation. As I say, we're off to Sicily in a couple of days, actually, for a holiday. But I'll be doing a little bit of work there as well. And I've been working in Calabria, in the mainland, at the bottom of the mainland, with a bunch of inspired social activists who just say, okay, you know, we can't fight the mafia, so what we're going to do instead is we're going to set up a network of social enterprises that will make money ethically and legally, and we'll show future generations that a legal democratic economy is possible. And that's been, although sometimes a little bit scary, an enormous privilege.
Let's take your penultimate track. This is Roxane Alfasky, and she's a guitarist, and this is the Clair de Lune by Debussy, obviously written for the piano originally. Tell us about this.
Well, this is a track from my lovely daughter, Holly. I was a late arrival to the joys of fatherhood. I've got two children, Jamie's 21 and Holly's 18. I used to live across the county line in Somerset, and I came to Sherborne because my kids had to move to the Griffon School to do 2 years of A-levels, and a great experience it's been. But Holly, as part of her studies, did A-level music, and she was studying Debussy as part of that course. And I remember in my bedroom, in that 60s bedroom with my Dansette record player, having a wobbly old recording of the piano version of Clair de Lune. And I discovered this virtuoso French guitarist, a woman, Roxane, who plays an absolutely beautiful version of this. So this is for Holly, my daughter.
We're going to have to fade out of Debussy and Clair de Lune, played there by Roxane Alfasky from 2016, French guitarist. And Bill, let's come up to date. You haven't been a Sherborne resident all that long, have you?
Not at all. As I say, I came to Sherborne because my children were doing A-levels at the Griffon School. And my partner, Josephine, and I decided to make Sherborne our home because we kind of fell in love with it. So I'm a Sherborneister now, and rather gladly, yeah.
And what is current work activity? You're back to the writing, aren't you? That's
back to the writing. So semi-retired, but seems to be rewiring rather than retiring. Delightfully decided to do my community bit. So I'm a newly elected councillor, Liberal Democrat councillor on Sherborne Town Council. But I'm working on a book about those anti-mafia social movements in southern Italy and in Sicily, and that's going to take up much of my time. And Josephine, who is also a former journalist, whom I met a long time ago at ITN, and our lives went in separate ways, and we met up much later, Josephine's working on a couple of books as well. So I think it's going to be a writing a different kind of writing, reporting life.
But you're still travelling. You alluded to that earlier. So you're off to Sicily, did you say?
We're off to Sicily in a couple of days' time. Delightfully trying to be good climate change bunnies. We're getting the train. We're not flying. So it'll be a two-day journey in each direction. I'm looking forward to that enormously. I've got an Interrail pass for the first time since I was 21.
But there'll be some work involved in that.
There'll be some work in the sense that I'm going to be visiting anti-mafia groups and some activists just to find out how they're getting on. Mm. But there'll be a lot of holiday as well and some very good Sicilian food.
And tell us about the council. I mean, that's something you've come to very late in life. Is this a political ambition that you're fulfilling, or is it just, as you say, a community service thing?
Mainly community service, I think. I always took the view, the old-fashioned view, that professional journalists shouldn't be politicians, that they should be able to be unbiased and independent. But I thought, well, now that I'm semi-retired and looking at the chaos that's going on politically in London, if we can do some community work that re-establishes the value of local politics and building not only a better community, but a sense of hope that things can change, then I'd like to give that a go. I stood for election for the first time in my life, to my very great surprise and delight. I got elected, so there we are.
And what do you think are the main issues that the council needs to address in Sherborne at the moment?
One of the main difficulties is that local government is still in a state of austerity. So how can you make things better while not raising the council tax or raising it as little as possible? And I hope, I speak personally here, I mean, the council as a whole is still working all these things out. I hope that Sherborne will become a much greener town, kind of on the climate, and that we'll save money by doing lots and lots of green measures. I want to explore new ways of raising money for local government, as other councils are doing. And I want to communicate better, not surprisingly, with the people of Sherborne to make local government much more of a community thing. But I think Sherborne is a beautiful town, has an awful lot going for it. But we need to be in a new age of, if you like, innovation in local government, because the money situation, the funding situation is not going to get better quickly. And we need to find new and intelligent ways of improving our communities and not expecting the money to trickle down from central government.
And what does the future look like for you? Any further ambitions to fulfil in life?
I would like to know that I'm relatively free of corporate life. I want to keep writing, write more. I want to travel as much as I can, do my council work, and keep cooking. I love cooking, and not least love eating. So one of my great pleasures is we've got a big table in the middle of the house, and at a push, we can get about 14, 15 people around that. So that's one of my great delights, a big bunch of people around the table. And the noise of people not only eating and having a glass of wine, but just chatting. And that seems to me one of the great sources of life.
Bill, it's been great talking to you. Thank you for coming in. Go out with your last piece, which is the RTE Concert Orchestra. And this is a flash mob. Tell us about this.
So this tune, Ian Copland, that Fanfare for the Common Man, throughout much of my lifetime, it had been conceivable that we as a species would be annihilated. You know, if you think of the nuclear threat, 9/11, now climate change. And this is one of the tunes that when I feel a bit down, I put this on and say, OK, get up, do something. This was played by the brass section of and the percussion of the RTE Concert Orchestra, the Irish broadcaster, at the start of a music festival in the middle of Dublin Airport while everybody's arriving. And you see on the YouTube video of this, everybody just suddenly stopping in their tracks, turning round and saying, wow.
Apart from anything else, it's quite loud, isn't it? So that's probably why.
Sorry, folks, it's Sunday morning.
This is from 2012, and it's a flash mob performance, as we say, by the RTE Concert Orchestra of Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. Bill, thank you very much for coming in. We wish you well in whatever further directions your career takes.
And thank you for having me. It's been lovely.